Good evening. This is Mimi Poser at the Guggenheim. I can think of no better way to introduce tonight's program than to quote from John Canaday's opening remarks in his New York Times review of the Ferdinand Hodler exhibit. Quote, Ferdinand Hodler, the subject of an important exhibition that opened at the Guggenheim Museum yesterday, occupies such a curious position in the history of late 19th century painting that one hardly knows whether to say that this excellent summary brings him back into the mainstream of art history, where he belongs, or reveals his peculiar isolation within it. In either case, the exhibition is long overdue, and plaudits are in order all along the line for the institutions that provided the opportunity and the individuals who made the most of it. Hodler is here, and it would seem that everyone is happy. However, there are those for whom the question remains, who is Hodler? Our guests this evening are among those most qualified to answer this question. They are the co-organizers of the exhibition. Eva Weiler, the art historian, and Peter Seltz, director of the University Art Museum in Berkeley, California, where incidentally the show originated. I would like to ask you both to address yourselves to the question posed by Canaday. Does this summary bring him back into the mainstream of art history where he belongs, or does it reveal his peculiar isolation within it?
Well, I think we have to ask what was the mainstream. If we mean the art of the end of the 19th century, around the 1890s, with his search for content in art and style, I think he certainly shared it. Whether he was part of the mainstream, I don't know if I can answer.
Well, I don't know what the mainstream is. This is a term which is constantly being misused. And it seems to me that the mainstream changes from generation to generation, depending on how we look at it, how new artists look at it. People who are way out on the side of the mainstream suddenly become the mainstream because they stimulate new artists and new discussion and new scholarship. So the word mainstream doesn't mean very much. It's a very, very misused term, and you can always stick everything you want into it. Hodler was not in the mainstream in one sense, if the mainstream is considered what was happening in Paris. He was pretty much isolated in Switzerland, working very much by himself. On the other hand, he had a great influence on many people, on the Germans, on the Austrians, on all kind of development which took place afterwards.
Why don't we get more specific about these two issues that you've just raised? How aware of was Hodler of the movements taking place in Europe at that time, and to what extent did they influence his work?
Well, it seems that when he was fairly young, he was very much familiar with the work of Corot. Later on, he knew what was going on in Paris. He knew Degas, he knew Rodin. He was certainly influenced by a very important French artist, Puvis de Chavannes. And later on, he probably also knew the work of people like Cézanne and Gauguin. And he used all that in his own very, very peculiar way for his own kind of art, which was very different from other people's, which was a symbolist kind of painting, which dealt with ideas to a great extent. And his landscapes, which were very different again, which was very extremely beautiful pictures. He used a great deal, but he used it and made it very much his own.
Well, I would like to disagree somewhat. I don't really know how well he knew what was happening in Paris. He certainly must have heard of Gauguin and so on, but it's not sure. He went to Paris in 1891 when his first symbolic work, The Night, was exhibited there at the Salon. By that time, Gauguin was in Tahiti, Seurat had died. He seems not to have mentioned any of these great painters and did have contact with some of the minor nabis, that followers of Gauguin. And his landscapes, his beautiful landscapes, were painted much later. I think certainly by osmosis, he shared in the search of those painters. I don't think that his art was all that different in aim as that of Gauguin and the others who search for structure. So I think he certainly shared this part and is not isolated in that sense.
Well, let me also say this, that this idea of working towards structure was very much of a post-impressionist idea. The impressionists, having dissolved structure into light impressions, We're followed by a generation like Gauguin, like Seurat, like Cézanne, and Hodler belongs very much into that, which brought a new solid structure into painting. And another thing I think is important, and which Hodler shared with other men of his time, like Gauguin and Edvard Munch, and that is idea painting, painting which is not mere delectation, but which works in terms of ideas and concepts, universal ideas, matters of life and death. He painted the day and people dying and all that. And this kind of working with ideas, I think, is very important. And furthermore, I think this is one reason why Hodler is so important to us right now, in a new kind of search for idea and content in art, rather than, let's say, the decorative art of the 60s.
Let's project a little further in time. Around 1905 to 1910, De Brucke had already been formed, De Blauw-Reiter, Kandinsky, at around 1910, had done his first non-objective painting. Picasso was into his experiments in cubism and was indeed into the second by 1910, the second phase. Was he at all aware of this?
I don't know if he was aware of it, but he certainly was not influenced by it. He was really considered among the avant-garde artists around 1904 with the Vienna Secession that had been initially organized by Gustav Klimt. And that was a whole different group of people who were involved in Jugendstil Art Nouveau expression, the very linear expression. And he was really one of the very famous artists of Europe at that time in Germany and Austria.
I would put it the other way. I would say they were aware of him. There's no question that in Austria, let's say, he was Klimt's friend, that Schiele derived a great deal from Hodler. That you mentioned the Germans, you mentioned the Brücke. Nolde, who was a member of the Brücke, had tremendous admiration for Hodler. You mentioned the Blauw-Reiter. Jawlensky went to see Hodler with great admiration. So it's really the other way around. Hodler was much older than they, who had already arrived at a much earlier time, was a starting point for many of them. So it really goes the other way.
I think this might be a good time to give a little background on Hodler. What kind of person was he? What were the influences that formed him personally?
Well, I think one of them is that he came from a very poor background and really had to struggle.
I think one thing that we forgot to mention, that he was born in
Switzerland. That he was born in Switzerland in 1853. And that his painting came to maturity in the 90s. So he puts him into that generation.
I think another interesting point is that he was an autodidact. He had no no real formal training until he got
some formal training,
Geneva.
But
until he got to Geneva later on. But he comes out of an isolated place and then somehow pushes himself into the forefront and knew where the important things were going, but always stayed very much of a loner to a great extent.
Well, yes, but Geneva was at that time not so isolated. It was a center of a cultural center and also a center of artistic teaching. So they really should have known what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Hodler always felt that his figure paintings were more important than his landscapes. Do you agree or disagree that they are his more significant works?
I certainly agree.
Yes, I would agree too, and I think the way we put the show together was with a great stress on the important figure paintings. Landscapes are very beautiful. When we had the show in Berkeley, I would say that the vast majority of the people who saw the show preferred the landscapes. They're easier to like. They're more ingratiating.
Would you discuss now the difference between the figure paintings and the landscapes and how he felt about it and how you feel about them?
Well, he felt about the landscapes that they were sort of things that he would do in his spare time in the summers, that he would things that he enjoyed doing, but this, he certainly did not feel that they were his significant contribution. His significant contribution, he felt, were the symbolic figure paintings. Paintings to some extent which illustrated a theory that he had. And in a way, this is also a shortcoming, that he was a man who was who had a theory of life and art, which he called parallelism, a theory of the unity of being. And the symbolic paintings dealing with life and death and the unity of being, many of them with a pantheist content, in a way illustrated a theory and illustrated it extremely well. Would you agree with that?
Not quite. I would say that the theory, what you call parallelism...
Would you explain parallelism for...
Well, parallelism was actually should be seen as a compositional device which consisted of the repetition of similar forms and lines for the purpose of intensifying expression. And I think it was also, it worked as a metaphor with which he was able to convey his ideas, his spiritual ideas of the unity of man and his equality before the forces of life. I don't think that his paintings actually illustrate parallelism. It's rather vice versa.
Well, I think it works both ways. I think there are times when it becomes too illustrative of the idea around 1900. Then by 1910, he gets away from this, then becomes very free. And I think some of the late paintings are both the figure paintings and the landscapes, and especially this extraordinary series which is on the show of slow deaths of his closest friend, his mistress, Valentine Adore.
That's a subject I want to get onto later. Would you say that towards the end of his life he abandoned his theoretical approach to painting?
I think he becomes much freer. I think it becomes much part of him.
The later landscapes.
He doesn't worry about it anymore. Yeah. It's part of him by
that time. Even though he continues to make symbolical works until the very end. I think we don't have any of his last period, but he still remains his primary.
Well, some of the landscapes go up to 1918.
I'm speaking of the symbolic works, large scale figure compositions, which he did paint, and he continued to paint historical paintings, which also kind of sort of exemplify, which are also idea paintings. I think they should be seen like that.
It seems that the later landscapes are going much more towards the abstract.
Absolutely, absolutely. Some of them have a Mondrian-like quality, as a matter of fact, as somebody has observed. And he does all kinds of things toward the end. He works on unsized canvas, which some misinforming art historians and critics have told us was something that originated in Washington 15 years ago. People have always done that. Hodler certainly did it. He worked with an extremely free brush and becomes very, very abstract. And I think that kind of abstraction that he achieves toward the end, or close abstraction, really did not have very much to do with people like Kandinsky, who painted completely abstract pictures by that time. But it simply is a development that he achieved in his own right, leads toward that, a freedom that he achieved toward the end.
Well, I think it comes from really late 19th century painting, which you do see the background become more and more two-dimensional. You see it in Art Nouveau, and then you can see it in Hodler in his early paintings of 1904, and you see it in Matisse then in 1905. So this is really the period too, and I think just quite unconsciously, all painters were affected by this trend.
Something interesting that I observed was that his landscapes were always fairly small, and the figure paintings were colossal.
Right.
Did he ever paint a large landscape?
No.
Is there any explanation for that? Did he ever write about it? He did write extensively.
Well, I think this is sort of a practical one. He was interested in group composition, group of figures, and you simply need more space to say the same thing as you in a landscape, I think.
He also was a muralist. No, he painted murals all over. He painted murals in Hanover. He painted murals in Zurich. He painted his greatest work, a large mural, in Jena. He was the first modern painter working on a large scale. I think this is very important to emphasize. There was really nobody since the early 19th century.
Well, Puvis de Chavannes.
But in a much more modern style.
How do you explain that? I know you have.
And then, of course, Matisse started that. I guess there was a drive toward this. Eva was saying just now there was a drive toward this large figure composition which had to be big in scale the way he visualized it.
Well, I think you can also see this in Gustav Klimt. He also did murals. And Munch also has some.
That's true.
I think this too was a tendency.
Would you discuss Hodler's use of color?
Well, it changes very much. In the early works, he works with very dark. He works in a very dark 19th century tradition, and then by the 1880s, by the late 80s, he suddenly things begin to be very, very light, and which probably
in his landscapes.
And then this gets transformed in his figures too, like even some of the early figure paintings that we saw in Geneva, they become very, very light, and suddenly light really enters in, and that becomes very important for the rest of his work. This may or may not have something to do with his knowledge of Corot, who also was really the first person to work with who brought light into painting prior to the Impressionists. But it might have come on his own. But light certainly enters in and stays with him, and there's a whole palette becomes beautifully, beautifully lit.
But he's not really a colorist, wouldn't you say?
I would say that's true. Yeah.
Because even in the teaching of his teacher, drawing was of primary importance, and I think it was Men who said that painting was really drawing colored. And I think this remains with him.
Except in the late landscapes and late self-portraits. Yes. And those late landscapes and late portraits, they gain a looseness, which in a way comes with the style of an old man. I mean, we see it in Titian, we see it in Rembrandt. There's a looseness that happens when a great artist reach a certain true maturity.
There's a looseness, but there's also a lack of drawing, and that, I think, was his really great his greatness. It was the drawing.
I was going
to
say,
in old age, there is no more. At least in the landscapes.
Well, the landscapes lose the linear quality of the drawing. And he doesn't outline. Yes. There's not that insistent contour line anymore. I think something interesting that was brought out was that he painted from his window towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
He was no longer well enough to
out. And he just stood in front of his window and painted.
He had something
Geneva.
Nice to paint, right?
That's right, the beautiful, beautiful scene across.
I think one other interesting thing that came out was that he was the first one to paint the mountains close up.
That's right.
The reason
That's
for that right. was interesting too, Eva.
Yes, I think they had just discovered or just made the funicular, which led up to the mountains. And so one painted mountains
there.
From close up.
And he really had a sense of the mountain. Nobody had ever painted the Alp, the mountain, the way he did. And nobody did it since. There's a real feeling, maybe only a Swiss can have it, I'm not sure. But there's a real, real feeling for the massive, the quality of the mountain as mountain.
Yes and no. It always stays to me. He sets it against a flat background, and it doesn't have the strength to me that his portraits have.
No, he does to me.
It does.
He certainly died. And there's one picture on the show called Eigermönch und Jungfrau in the Moonlight, which is, I think, is one of the most
beautiful. Yes, but that has nothing to do with
seen.
The mountain, really.
It has
really,
feeling. The feeling of the high altitude.
Beautiful.
Being way, way up in the Alps.
Well, it's the moonlit view of the mountains. Why was Hodler so preoccupied with the subject of death? And by way of explaining it, I'd like you to tell how this manifests itself in his work.
Well, it manifests itself in several paintings of a dying woman. I don't really know whether he was all that preoccupied, although it certainly was an important thing in his life. His parents, his brothers and sisters all died of tuberculosis, and so death was a very early experience
in his life. And he writes about how death was constantly permanent in his youth. And then I think he's
preoccupied. But he doesn't paint it as much. We just happen to have shown a series of a dying woman because they are so deeply felt.
Well, that's a rather unique series.
I think it may have been sort of our bias rather than.
But before that, he died. He did Madame Dupin dying. Before that, he painted one of his close friends, a poet named Tucosal, on his deathbed. Before when he painted the murals, he painted instead of fighting warriors, he painted dying warriors. We have one of those. In the show,
he illustrated
the defeat of the Swiss army at Marignano. When he painted his great mural in Jena, he painted people marching toward death. I think it's a preoccupation, which is one of the unique things about Hodler, which he really only shares with Munch, and where he becomes maybe at his greatest.
Well, I have to disagree. I'm sorry. I don't think he shares that with Munch at all. I don't think he's a decadent painter, and I don't think he's a morbid painter. I think he always sort of remains his foothold in the concrete and he's extremely positive. And I think this death theme is
Well, I would not call Munch a decadent painter either, but...
Well, I think Munch is a great painter, but I mean, he's
every day he went to see his friend and watched her dying, dated it day by day, was tremendously occupied with watching the disease progressing and death taking hold of her.
Yes, but I think we have to
explain to our audience that there's a great series that Hodler painted of his mistress, Valentine Godet d'Arel, and he literally chronicled day by day her death. How many are there in that series, incidentally?
Well, I think in the show, I don't forget how many there are. There are a large number of drawings and paintings, and there are a great many that are not in the show.
But I'd just like to say, I think his observation there is extremely objective and clinical, and I think it's much closer to almost to new objectivity of painting after the World War than it is to the spirit, the morbid spirit of fin de siècle.
Well, I would agree with that, but I think the fact that he chose that particular topic has a tremendous ramifications. And the way he painted it was fairly cool.
Right, that's what I mean.
Peter, you had some interesting comments in your lecture at the Guggenheim the other day about Hodler's attitude towards women as contrasted, for example, with Klimt's. Would you say something about that?
Well, I think what I said is that in Klimt, the woman becomes a carrier of decoration. I think I mentioned that, and I showed some Klimt to show that. In other words, a decorative object, which is very much what the woman is in Art Nouveau in general. Whereas in Hodler, it's a life force.
Thomas Messer, the director of the Guggenheim, suggests that Hodler's work reflects the transition from the 19th to the 20th century art, in that it contains elements of both. Would you both comment on that?
Well, I think we've already said a good deal along that line, and I certainly would agree with that, and it is very much in that in-between place, where he belongs. And he comes out of the 19th century, and he's one of the people, one of the post-impressionists who lead into a new concept of painting.
Eva, did you want to say something?
Well, I would agree too, and I think it just probably is a very clear example.
In addition to this exhibition, there have been major exhibitions recently in Switzerland, Vienna, and London. Why do you think that there's a revived interest in Hodler at this time? Or why do you think the public is ready to receive Hodler now?
It may have something to do with the whole interest in new figuration that's been going on everywhere, with the whole interest in symbolic ideas. I found in Berkeley again that the students, the young people, very much interested in this kind of universal symbolist, universalist, and cosmic concept that he had. And also, you know, here's a great painter who's been overlooked, and it's marvelous to see his work.
Well, it helps complete our understanding of a certain period.
Before we leave the air, I'd like to remind our listeners that the Hodler Show will be on view at the Guggenheim until April 8th, and then it travels on to Harvard's Bush Risingham Museum in Cambridge. And now I'd like to thank Peter Seltz and Eva Weiler for being with us this evening. And to our audience, good night.